Okay, Genesis 16, and please turn there. I'm going to open up to the chapter, go ahead and read it, we'll pray, and then we'll dig in. Genesis 16, verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go in to my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went in to Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please." And Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?" She said, "I am fleeing from my mistress Sarai." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit to her." And the angel of the Lord also said to her, "I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are pregnant and shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him, and he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen." So she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are a God of seeing," for she said, "Truly here I have seen him who looks after me." Therefore the well was called Beer Lahoy. Laharoi, it lies between Kadesh and Bered. And Hagar bore Abram a son. And Abram called the name of his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. Let's pray. Lord God, we thank you for your word. We pray that you would help us to get everything out of it that we need to today, that it would feed, nourish our souls. It would instruct us in the ways in which we should go, and it would reveal to us your tender mercy and compassion towards sinners. May the unfolding of it give light to our path, and may we walk by the light it provides. Amen. So, over the last few weeks, the time that we've been able to spend with Lois has been sweet. As heartbreaking as it is, it's been really neat to see the family kind of rally around her and to be able to have this time to spend with her before her passing. And one of the things that has been neat to see is everybody is bringing these old photographs. So we get to see photos of Lois, you know, from 30, 40 years ago, or photos of her children who were really young and you can't really hardly tell who they are, and photos of a lot of people that you don't even know who they are. And if you've ever done anything like that before, you know that if you ever flip through the old family albums, you know that you're going to encounter some photos and you're going to have a struggle trying to figure out, why is this person in this photo? How did they end up here? And who are they? And why are they standing next to my mom? Or something along those lines. And those are the people that we tend to forget, the people that were a part of our lives for a very short period of time. Who we even have some evidence of that they were there, they've left their mark, and then they're gone. Hagar is like one of those people showing up in this photo of Abram and his wife Sarai, who seem to be together here for a moment, just a moment here in chapter 16, and then just another moment again in chapter 21, and then she simply disappears. You can imagine how awkward this photo would be. Abram, the 86-year-old man with his 75-year-old wife next to presumably a younger Egyptian slave who is showing off the baby that will be born to her, the son that she has been given. And you may think, well, it sure looks like perhaps Hagar is Abram's daughter. And this is their daughter and their grandson, and this is just a happy picture of a beautiful family. You would be mistaken, though, if that was your conclusion. So pictures, however this picture sticks in your mind, is misleading. Here we have an incident that Sarai is going to take center stage in the biblical story for the first time in the story of Abram. For the second time in the Bible, a woman becomes the main character of a chapter. So let that kind of resonate and reverberate in your mind. We'll return to that in a moment. But we're introduced to this scene now, immediately after God makes a covenant with Abram. We have this story about Sarai and about Abram and about Sarai's slave, Hagar. These characters are introduced to us in verse 1. We see who they are, and then we learn the important part that they're going to play, the roles that they're going to have in the rest of the story. So verse 1 sets the stage for us. And it reminds us of the issue that has been a problem ever since we found out that Abram was married to Sarai. Remember, all the way back at the end of chapter 11, Moses tells us that Sarai is married to Abram, but Sarai can bear no children. She is barren. And then we gap, you know, four chapters until chapter 16 when this is brought up again. So here we're returning to a theme that we're introduced to all the way back at the beginning of Abram's story, and now we're going to see what Sarai did to solve her problem, what she attempted to do to bring about a removal of her barrenness, to in some sense have a child for her own. So that's what this story here is about. We know that God has promised Abram that he is going to give him a multitude of descendants. His offspring will be as numerous as the dust of the earth. It will be as numerous as the stars of the sky, more numerable than the stars that you can count. So we know that this is what God has promised to him, that he would have an heir to inherit the land that God has promised to give him. His offspring will dwell within the land. That's all of the details and the specifics that we have from chapter 15. But here, what we have is we have a barren woman, we have a slave, an Egyptian slave, and we have Abram. What is going to take place in this story? How is this going to be? How is this going to work itself out? So we see here Sarah's plan. Sarah's plan is to give her slave, Egyptian slave, to Abram as a wife so that she can actually have a child of her own, that she can be built up through the offspring of her slave, her Egyptian slave. So let's see what we're told here in the first few verses. Verse 2, we see how the plan is described by Sarai. Sarai said to Abram, "Behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go in to my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." Now notice a few things about this statement that she makes. Notice that in one sense, she is blaming God for her inability to conceive. The Lord has prevented me from bearing children. So in some sense, she sees that God has been the cause of her barrenness. God is the one who is blocking or stopping her from conceiving and having a child. So she has perhaps reflected upon the promise that God gave to Abram, and she has come to the realization that she is never going to be able to have a child, and she thinks that God is the one who is doing that. God has somehow blocked her from conceiving, stopped her from having children. Now, we don't know exactly how much of this she is attributing to God directly, as if he is the cause from it or has been the cause. Presumably, she's known for quite some time now that she can't have any children. She has been married to Abram for a while, we're assuming. She is older, so we're assuming that their marriage has been normal, and they have realized that they cannot have children together. And now she's at the point where she's thinking that God is the one who has caused this to happen. On the one hand, we know that God has the ability to bring about new life. He alone has the ability to cause someone to conceive. I mean, that's the testimony of the Bible. We're going to see in chapter 20 that God is going to prevent the household of Abimelech from conceiving. He is going to, in some sense, intervene in that particular situation to cause the women from being unable to conceive and have children. And it's the same word that's used there as it's used here by Sarai. The Lord has prevented me from bearing children. But I want you also to notice here who Sarai is thinking about. Now, she's not simply reflecting upon their situation and thinking to herself that I am unable to produce children for my husband, Abram. No, notice what her focus is upon. Her focus is on herself. The Lord has prevented me from having children. It may be that I shall obtain children by her, by Hagar. Now, this provides a little bit of a different twist to the normal way that we read the chapter. Sarai is not thinking here, at least from what, if we take her language, she's not thinking here primarily about how she can fulfill God's promise to Abram to give him heir, to give him an heir, or to give him descendants, or to give him an offspring. She is thinking about herself. She is thinking about how God has caused her to be unable to conceive. How perhaps through Hagar, Sarai can become a mother. She can be built up. She can have a multitude of descendants. So Sarai's focus, however accurate it may be to describe this as God keeping her from something that she wants, she is motivated by what she wants. This is something that she wants for herself, not necessarily something that she wants for her husband. And what is her plan then? Her plan is to use her handmaid, her maidservant, her slave, to get children for herself. So what is Sarai doing? She's resorting to a custom of the day. She's resorting to giving her slave to her husband in order that she may have children. Now, this is not the first time we're going to see something like this happening in the Bible. This is exactly what several wives are going to do later on. They're going to give their maid servants to their husband so that they can have children. So this is going to be a thing that happens repeatedly throughout the Bible. And what we're constantly going to see is that there's going to be this, call it a competition, if you will, between women about bearing children. So this is something that's tied to the curse that God pronounces upon the woman about bearing children. We normally think that has to do with the physical pain that a wife endures in bearing a child and giving birth to a child. That's not the pain that's not just the pain that is talked about in the curse that God pronounces upon the woman. There's a lot of other pain associated with childbearing, and one of those pains is barrenness. And one of those pains is the competition that occurs between wives. And one of those pains is how those children respond to one another after they've been born. All of this has a factor in seeing how God's curse carries itself through in upon the first woman in Genesis chapter 3. So what is her plan? Her plan is to resort to this custom of her day and to use this custom to have children for herself. Now, it's interesting, if we look back at Genesis 12, we see that Abram did something similar when he was put into a difficult situation, a situation of his own unbelief. He was fearful of the Egyptians, thinking that they're going to kill him, so he persuaded Sarai to say that she is his sister so that they won't kill him and take her to be their wife. Now, he himself was resorting to a custom of the day. He was falling back upon the tried and true custom. If we can simply just say that you're my sister, not my wife, then my life will be saved, and yours will be, well, we don't really care about you. Now, what is Sarai doing? She's doing something similar. She's falling back upon a custom to give this slave woman to her husband so that she can have, so her life can be saved. She can be built up and have children of her own. Apparently, Hagar has no say in the matter whatsoever. In Sarai's mind, Hagar is simply a tool that she can use to get what she wants. We can say the same about her husband. Her husband is simply a tool that she can use to get what she wants. So Abram just simply goes along with the plan. Sarai shares it with him. This is what I want to do. God has prevented me from having this. This is what I want. And I want you to give me what I want. So take my maidservant. Take her to be your wife. And have a child with her so that I can be built up. So what happened? Well, everything worked out exactly like Sarai had planned. Halfway through verse 2, Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And they all lived happily ever after. That's the photo. That's the picture that you have in your mind. Here it is. You know, soon after their wedding day, Hagar is pregnant. Abram and Sarah are there with smiles on their faces. And they're just as happy as ever. Now, I think what we need to do here is just linger a little bit on these verses. These verses are incredibly telling. At first glance, we see that Sarai's plan does appear to work. How does it work? Well, Abram goes along with it. Hagar goes along with it. They get married, and Hagar conceives. So here we are with Sarah unable to conceive, and Hagar able to conceive. And now the child that she is going to bear is going to become Sarai, so she is going to be built up. This looks like Sarai has actually solved her problem. It looks like in her eyes that this has ended Sarai's barrenness. Hagar conceives and now Sarai can have a family. So they've waited this long, 10 years in the land, they've waited for offspring. And considering the fact that they probably have waited for 40 or 50 years up until this point, we now come to an end of their waiting. Now Sarai can have a child. So this is a time of rejoicing. But we know that it's not. How do we know that? If we're reading this text closely, we already know what to expect. We can already see what's coming from a mile away. We know that these three, caught up in this surrogacy, if you will, are going to end up on the Jerry Springer show. How do we know that? Well, let me ask you this. Can you think of another story in Genesis when a passive husband listens to his wife as she takes something forbidden and gives it to him? All of those trigger words from what we see in Genesis 3 are here in Genesis 16. Abram listens to Sarai. And what does God say before he pronounces his curse upon Adam? Because you listen to your wife. Mistake number one. And what did Sarai do? She took her servant, the Egyptian slave, Hagar, and she gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. Just like the woman, Eve, took the fruit and gave it to her husband. So what we see here is not simply a repeat of the failure of the first man and the woman in the garden, but we see something very similar. This is just another similar failure, kind of described using the same language that shows us that Abram, Sarai, and Hagar are all failing at this moment. And this is what it looks like for the curse to be working itself out in human relationships. This is what it looks like when man takes oversteps his boundaries and tries to enter into the world to get what it wants that God is preventing them from having. So what is it that the man and the woman in the garden wanted? They wanted the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. They wanted to taste its fruits. They wanted something good, but they wanted it not in God's timing, not in dependence upon God, not waiting for Him to bring about the promise. So here Sarah is wanting something good. She wants offspring. You can't fault her for that. But what does she do? She tries to get it her own way. And she tries to use other people in her life to get it. Use her husband, use her slave. So if we're reading the text in line with the way that we should, then we know that this is not going to work out. That this is going to be a disaster. That it's going to cause conflict, it's going to cause strife. There's going to be long-term repercussions in how this kind of plays itself out. So what do we see? Sarai, she's experienced the pain of barrenness, her pain in childbearing, and she seeks to rule her husband, to use her husband, to overthrow his authority, to manipulate the situation to get what she wants, to alleviate her pain. Abram, who's supposed to be the leader, goes along with it. He listens to his wife. Instead of trusting God to fulfill his promise, he allows Sarai to convince him that this is a good idea. Notice in the entire passage, up until verse 6, Abram doesn't say a word. He only says a word in verse 6, and then that's it. Abram is the silent participant in this grievous sin, the plan of Sarai. In all the way, they're trying to attempt to kind of keep this promise and keep and build Sarai up and give her an offspring. So what do we learn from that? We can see exactly how faithlessness works itself out in this situation. Instead of humbly submitting to God, who has prevented her from bearing children, and recognizing that if she is going to have children and if she is going to be built up, which seems to be specifically the promises that God has given to Abram, if she humbly submits and believes that, then God is going to work His purposes out in her heart. She needs to trust God to fulfill His promises. She needs to trust that God is going to watch out for her, to care for her, that she will be built up and she will be the model of faith if she trusts and believes and keeps clinging to the God who will keep His promises. Being hasty, being unbelieving, being faithless is never the solution. Sin is never the solution to your pain. Sin always overpromises and underdelivers. So here she has devised this plan, and it works to perfection, but what happens? What happens is that she gets what she wants, but then she realizes that this is not actually what she wants. You guys ever been there before? If you're truly a child of God, you cannot think that sinning is going to get you what you want. Sin is never going to get you what you want, what you really want deep down inside. But sin is going to trick you and deceive you and to make you think that it's going to give you what you want. But it's not going to do that. I think about Sarai here and her relationship with her husband. Sarai thinks that she can use Abram to get what she wants. But what happens? What happens is that she ends up blaming him, thinking that he's the one that's caused the problem. So she convinces her husband to go along with her plan, and then when it doesn't happen the way that she wants, and she realizes that causes a conflict in the household, she blames her husband for going along with her plan. This is the first and only time this has ever happened in the world. Now, I think this is in one sense, it's important for us to recognize this. That this is perhaps, you know, a very particular way that a wife can sin. A very particular way that a wife can sin in her home is to try to get her husband to do what she wants. And what happens with that? She uses her means, the means that God has given to her, whether good, godly means or whether ungodly means, chiding him or nagging him or yelling at him or comparing him to other men or controlling him or talking down to him or complaining about him or any variety of other things that she does to get her husband to be the person that she wants him to be. But what happens is that the husband ends up resenting her for it, and he does not become the person that she wants him to be. Why? Because those are not the means that God has given wives to respond to their husbands. The only way to get your husband to be the man that you want him to be is to do what the Scriptures tell you to do to your husband, and that is to respect him. So consider this as a cautionary tale. You know what you want, and you may want something good, but how are you going to go about that? Sarai's testimony, her witness, later on in the Scriptures, is one who submitted to her husband. She called him Lord. And what did Abram do? Abram put her in scary situations. And what did Sarai do when she was in those scary situations? She trusted the Lord. It's interesting, if you read 1 Peter 3, the focus is upon her trust in Yahweh, the trust in the Lord. Why? Because sometimes her husband is going to put her in situations where she doesn't feel like she can trust him. So she has to depend upon God in those situations. But here the roles are reversed. We need to see that. Okay, so let's look now at the aftermath. What happens after this plan kind of comes to fruition? To summarize, what happens is that Hagar despises Sarai. Sarai blames Abram. Abram washes his hands of the whole situation, and Sarai retaliates against Hagar, and then Hagar runs away with Abram's baby. And the rest of the chapter is going to focus upon what happens, how the Lord intervenes into this hot mess and preserves the life of Hagar and Hagar's son, Ishmael. And first, let's look at how this works itself out. So Sarai didn't anticipate, she didn't think through logically what would occur if Hagar actually conceives. She didn't think about how Hagar would respond to her or how she would feel about how Hagar responded to her. She was only thinking about what she could get out of the transaction, which is offspring. So now that Hagar has conceived, she kind of gets puffed up. Man. So she looks down upon Sarai. So this little slave girl now thinks that she's gotten a promotion because she is actually bearing the child of the patriarch, of Abram. Now, because she is pregnant, she is actually more important, perhaps, within the family structure than Sarai. So she looks upon Sarai with contempt. She actually, it's a word for curse. So she is in a sense looking at her with a curseful taste in her eyes. She despises her, resents her. Hagar looks down upon Sarai, and this infuriates Sarai. You can kind of imagine how easy that would be. But instead of repenting and confessing that her scheme was never going to work in the first place, and bringing that she was simply trying to manipulate the situation to get what she wanted, she blames her husband. Verse 5, basically, to summarize, it says, Sarai says to Abram, "This is all your fault." And Abram is dumbfounded. He was simply going along with her plan. How could it be my fault when it was your plan? But there's, you can't apply logic to the situation. This is all your fault, and God is going to get you for this. Let God judge between you and me. God is going to determine who is at fault here or not. I love Abram's response. You know, basically, Sarai is summarizing to him how Hagar has responded to her and calling Abram to account for it. And Abram's just like, whose slave is she? She's your slave. She's not my slave. Do with her whatever you want. Like, don't get me involved in this, right? I'm not a part of this. I don't have anything to do with it. For some reason, Sarai thinks that perhaps Abram does have something to do with it. Maybe he's behind this whole thing. So what is she doing? She's growing suspicious of her husband. Abram is just saying, just keep me out of it. She's your servant, not mine. Do with her whatever you want. Think of again, the garden narrative. What is it when God confronts these people after they've sinned? Well, they're hiding in the garden. Why? Because they're ashamed. Because they know they're naked. Who told you you were naked? Well, this woman that you gave me. She gave me the fruit. Who told you to eat the fruit? Well, serpent deceived me and I ate. You can see all of the blame game taking place here. Without recognizing really what's at the source of it, the cause. Hagar's contempt for Sarai. Sarai's blaming Abram. Abram's backing off. Keep me out of it. So what does Sarai do in response? Abram's command actually is interesting because he says, do to her as you please, which literally means do to her what is good in your eyes. We're thinking about the themes from the garden again. Something that is good in your eyes. Good to the taste. Good for food. Here now, Abram is instructing his wife Sarai to do what she thinks is good in this situation. What does Sarai do? She afflicts Hagar. Well, how far have people fallen, right? Do what's good in your eyes. Well, in my eyes, what this means is that I'm going to retaliate against my slave girl because she's despising me, so now I'm going to afflict her. That's what I think is good in my eyes. So Sarai deals harshly with her. She afflicts her. It's the same word that the Lord used in the previous chapter to describe what will happen to Abram's offspring. If you don't know, remember that this is what he says. They will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. Now think about what's taking place here. God tells Abram that his offspring will be afflicted by the Egyptians for 400 years. And then in the very next chapter, we see Abram's wife afflicting an Egyptian slave. So the roles are reversed. So through their faithlessness and willful disobedience, God's agents of blessing to the nations have become the source of affliction. They have become the oppressors. Now think about just the importance of that. Not just looking at this particular situation, but long term throughout the biblical story. When God's people fail to be who God's people are supposed to be, what ends up happening? They do not bring God's blessings to the nations. They're a source of strife, of conflict, of oppression. They're actually a tool for wickedness and evil. And here we have a snapshot of Abram and Sarai doing that same exact thing to the Egyptian slave Hagar, the sojourner in their land. So how bad did it get? Well, it got bad enough for Hagar to flee. So she runs away. And now you have a pregnant, runaway slave fleeing from the afflictions of her mistress. Sarai's probably thinking, good riddance, Abram probably doesn't even know that she left. There's no one going after her. So she is just on her way back home. She's going to Shur. She's in the wilderness in the northern Sinai Peninsula. She's heading back to Egypt. And it's not entirely true that there's no one going after her, because we do see one intervene. The rest of the story is about how God intervenes in Hagar's life. So again, the patriarch family, you know, the agents of God's blessing to the nations, they have gotten into a mess that leaves one place of recourse. God has to get involved. Where has God been? In verse 1 through 6. Well, the only place God has been in preventing Sarai from conceiving, and God is going to be the one who judges between the man and the woman. But there's nothing in there about them seeking the Lord. Hey, is this a good idea? There's nothing in there about them actually asking God if this is what they should do. Sarai just wants something, and she devises a way to get what she wants, and Abram goes along with it. There's no seeking the Lord whatsoever. But the Lord still intervenes, showing us His mercy, His tender-hearted compassion, His love for the oppressed, afflicted sojourner, stranger in the land. So God has been completely aware of everything that has taken place. He hasn't been called upon or sought for wisdom, but He has been there observing all of these details. And now He intervenes and instructs Hagar to go back. I think of what a shock that is. It was bad enough for her to leave and run away and go home. And now the Lord tells her what she ought to do, and that means go back to your mistress and submit to her. Now talk about God putting us back into a difficult situation. So the Lord finds Hagar by the spring, and sure, she's on her way home, and the Lord tells her to go back to her mistress and submit. Hagar must be thinking what we're thinking. You want me to go back to the person that was afflicting me? Did I hear you right? You want me to go back to the mistress that was treating me harshly? You want me to go back to being a slave? And the Lord says to Hagar, I didn't stutter, did I? He's clear. Go back. It's interesting. You think about Hagar. Is she? What role does she have in this? Is she the victim? Or is she the perpetrator? We could presume that perhaps as a slave, she had really no say in the matter whatsoever. So if her mistress wanted her to do this with her husband, which was the custom of the day, then she had to go along with it. But what did she have a say in? The way that she responded to Sarai, right? Did she have to look upon Sarai with contempt? Did she have to despise her? Did she have to dishonor her? Well, you can see how easily this could get twisted in either way, right? Obviously, she is one that's being afflicted. The Lord is going observes her affliction. He even says that He has heard her in her affliction. And yet she's also been the one who has afflicted Sarai. Now maybe Sarai shouldn't have taken that personally. But that's a key important word for us to see. We can see actually what the Lord is seeking to do here in bringing her back to Sarai and telling her and instructing her to go back to the one that's afflicting her. Why? Because by running away, she is distancing herself from Abram. And who is Abram? The source of blessing. The one that God has covenanted with. The one that God has made promises with. And her response to Sarai is actually going to be something that brings a curse upon her. So for the Lord to intervene and tell her to go back is the Lord telling her to go back to the source of blessing. How do we know that? We know that because of the word that's used to describe her contempt for Sarai. When she looks with contempt upon her mistress, that's the same word that's used back in Genesis 12, when God promised Abram that those who dishonor you, I will curse. After he says, those who bless you, I will bless, those who dishonor you, I will curse, what was Hagar doing? Hagar was dishonoring, same word, despising, cursing Sarai. And the way that that played itself out was that she was going back to Egypt away from the promised blessing, away from the one who would bring blessing into her life. So God instructs her to go back. Be reconciled to your mistress. Go back and submit to her. Submit yourself to her. Honor her in this way. No longer despise her. Because that is the only way that Hagar is going to be blessed. Just think about what if she goes back to Egypt? She goes back home. She may have her freedom. She may have a child. But what is that child going to do? He's going to become an Egyptian. And he's going to live there for 400 years. His descendants are going to live there for that long. And then his descendants are going to become wrapped up into the Pharaoh's army, who's going to seek to afflict the Israelites, and they're going to be brought out of Egypt, and then perhaps some of his descendants will be a part of the army that goes through the Red Sea and gets drowned by the waves. Going to Egypt is not where the blessing is to be found. You need to stay close to Abram. So the Lord tells her to go back. But it's not simply just a matter of instructing her and what she should do. He actually incentivizes her. He actually makes an extraordinary promise to her. Go back and what? I will multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. Now think about this. So if she were to run away, There doesn't seem to be the indication that the blessing is going to follow her, the blessing of a multiplied offspring, an innumerable multitude of descendants. But if she goes back, this is what the Lord promises to do. I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. Here, Hagar is promised that God is going to cause her descendants to be an innumerable multitude. She's going to have lots of kids and grandkids and great-grandkids. It's going to be a numerous people are going to descend from her through her son, Ishmael. So God incentivizes her obedience. There is kind of the ironic twist here. What was it that Sarai wanted? She wanted to be built up through an innumerable offspring. And what is it that Hagar gets? The blessing of a multitude of offspring, of descendants. So Hagar gets what Sarai wants, at least right now. So the beauty then is God's intervention in the life of Hagar, telling her to go back to the source of blessing, because it's only in connection to Abram that she will be blessed. And God incentivizes her obedience by telling her that she will have a multitude of offspring, that she will be multiplied. And we find later on, Ishmael's sons are called princes. So there's a sense in which his 12 sons become rulers, they become kings. And Hagar becomes the matriarch of this family of kings, of rulers. But the focus here is upon the poem that is described for us in 11 and 12 about how the Lord hears Hagar's anguish and how he provides a son for her, and he describes what this son will be. So she's told, you're pregnant, shall bear a son, you shall call his name Ishmael, which means God hears. Why is he called that? It's because the Lord has listened, or the Lord has heard your affliction. God has heard her cries of agony and her pain. He has heard and seen the experiences that she's gone through because of Sarai. He is with the tender-hearted, the oppressed, the poor. He is there as a source of refuge for them. God looks upon the affliction of this Egyptian slave girl that's got wrapped up into this problem. It's really a beautiful portrait of God. And the name Ishmael is actually a beautiful name, thinking about God's hearing his people. God is the God who hears. And every time she would say her son's name, she would be reminded that God had heard her agony in the wilderness at the well of water. Now Ishmael, I mean, you read 12, verse 12, it does not seem like that much of a compliment. If you were told that your son is going to be a wild donkey of a man, you would probably back out and say, no thanks. I'm not looking for a wild donkey. That sounds more like a pain in the donkey than it does a blessing. You prefer the kind of the soft, kind, gentle kid instead of the wild donkey of a man who seems to be engaged in nothing but conflict. His hand is against everyone. Everyone's hand is against him. He shall dwell over against his kinsmen. Well, this is the long-term effects of what God is going to do. This is actually not sort of, I mean, it's kind of a good depiction of what Ishmael would become. Not necessarily a blessing. There's a little bit of, obviously, heartache and hardship involved in this. But he is not going to be one who is oppressed. He's going to be a fighter. He's going to be a nomad. He's going to be out there on the boundaries. He's going to be kind of an independent man. But he's not going to be oppressed. He's not going to be afflicted by others. In fact, he's going to be the one who's engaged in these kind of conflicts for his life. That's what he's going to know. But he's going to dwell over his kinsmen, not be ruled by them. So his life is not going to be like Hagar's. Even though she's a slave, even though she's afflicted by her mistress, her son's life is not going to be like that. And God's strange providence, what we see happening long term, is that the descendants of Ishmael become a thorn in the side of Abram's descendants. The ones that they're engaged in conflict with are going to be Abram's other sons, grandsons, the innumerable offspring that God gives to Abram. Here we have kind of a pattern that's being just spoken about in these basic ways, right at the beginning of what's going to take place. Paul says in Galatians 4 that this conflict that takes place between the descendants of Abraham, the descendants of Ishmael, the descendants of Isaac, is actually something that's still going on in his day. Just like it was back then, so it is today. You can see that for 1,500 years, Ishmael is going to be this small little problem about Sarai coming up with a solution to her problem, seeking to get what she wants, is going to be something that her descendants actually have to deal with for that long a time. So Hagar recognizes then that this is the place that God sees her. So her son is named because God has seen her in her affliction. He has heard her in her affliction. And she names the place. She actually gives it a unique name, El Roy, meaning the God who sees. And she says she names it that place because she knows that God sees her in her distress, in her affliction. God is the one who looks after me. So God's heart then for this slave, this runaway slave child, is demonstrated in the fact that Hagar names her the God who sees. This is the God who is and does not forget the afflicted, the God who is their refuge, the one who hears them and delivers them out of the hands of their oppressors. So Hagar shows us God's heart for the afflicted, for those that have been trampled upon, for the sojourners, the strangers, those who are mistreated. just as God speaks frequently throughout the Bible about having a heart for the widows, for the orphans, He has a heart for those like Hagar. In those same situations. Even if she has been the one who has brought it about in some sense. So interestingly here, we don't have her response. We just have a very repetitious conclusion to the chapter that is significant. What we're told here is basically that assuming that Hagar must have went back, but she bears a son. She bears a son for Abram. Hagar bore Abram a son. Abram called the name of his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. Three times we're told that Hagar bears a son. She has a child, but it's Abram's son. It's not Sarai's. At this point, it's not that Hagar has been cut out of the picture. It's that Sarai has been cut out of the picture. Sarai is the barren one at the beginning of the chapter. And now we have Hagar, her slave child, bearing a son for Abram at the end of the chapter. It's significant that she is absent. She is gone. She leaves the scene at verse 6 and she doesn't show up again. But here we have this picture of God's word coming to pass, His purposes coming to pass, even through this slave girl, that Abram has a son. This is going to be an important part when we get to a few of these other chapters, 17, 18, 21. It's going to be Abram's desire, his heart for his son, Ishmael, his firstborn, to be the one that God blesses. And God is going to bless Ishmael, but he's not going to be the one that God makes a covenant with. The promises and the blessings of the covenant don't get passed off to Ishmael, even though Ishmael is going to multiply and be fruitful and have a number of descendants. That gets reserved for the son of the promise, not the son of the flesh. This is an important distinction to make. Yes, Abram has a son at the end of chapter 16. But this is a son that comes from human faithlessness, human ingenuity, human reliance upon their own means, and not a dependence upon God to keep His promises. So Abram has a son, one that he will love dearly and wants to be the promised son, but he's not going to be the promised son. That one comes later. That one comes as a result of God's quickening power to cause Sarai to conceive and have a child. One that can only come through the hand of God. One who can only come through the power of God working in this barren woman's womb. That is the son that gets the blessing. That is the son that God makes a covenant with. He is the one who inherits Abram's promises. So what do we get from this text? We get to focus upon the God who shows mercy, the God who shows compassion, the tender-hearted God that sees those who are being afflicted. He draws near and He intervenes in even the worst situations to bring about His purposes. But we also see the consequences of going about it our own way. That's the danger of living a faithless life. If we don't do it in reliance upon God, if we don't trust Him to keep His promises, then it's not simply a matter of forgetting the promises that God made. It means that we're going to seek what God promises to give, but we're going to do it in our own way, and that's always going to place us into a dangerous situation. Sin is not the answer. Disobedience is not the answer. Trying to manipulate the situation to get what we want is not the answer. We need to trust God to provide what we need. We need to trust God to bring about the fulfillment of His promises. We need to trust God to do His work in our hearts and our lives and in the sticky situations that we find ourselves in. So trust Him. Look to Him, the God who keeps His promises, the God who is near to you in your affliction, in your trials, in your struggles, in your grief, the God who is near, the God who sees. Look to the God who sees you in your distress and trust Him. Let's pray.